From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Of all the issues facing Utah's Latino community, housing, economic inequality, social integration, there's one that actually isn't much of an issue these days: immigration. There was a boom in the 90s, a massive influx. The Latino population grew by staggering amounts, but that movement has mostly stopped now, which hasn't dampened the political rhetoric about undocumented workers. It might be worth noting that Latinos got here first. There's a little irony in pointing out the Utah Territory was part of Mexico when the Mormon pioneers first came and settled illegally. Today in the program, we're talking about Latinos in Utah. We'll talk about their history, their demographics, and the challenges they faced and still face. Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we hope you'll consider joining them. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. Visit us online at KUER.org for details. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo changed things, but it's important to remember the Utah Territory was part of Mexico when the Mormon pioneers decided to settle here, which is just one way of reminding ourselves just how deep is the history of Latinos in this region. They have been here almost as long as there has been a here. In the beginning, it was exploration, of course, that brought them, and then agriculture and ranching and mining. In the 1990s, there came a massive surge, which was cut short by the economic collapse in 2008. The historian Armando Solorzano says the history of Latinos in Utah is really complicated, complex, he says. It's a convoluted interaction shaped by Native Americans, Spaniards, Mexicans, Hispanics, not to mention the French and the Europeans. The Hinckley Institute of Politics is hosting its annual Siciliano Forum. This year's focus is on the future of U.S. Latin American relations, which is giving us a chance to talk about some of the issues of Utah's Latino population. We invite you to join the conversation if you like. If you have comments or questions, 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Let me introduce the panel we have who's going to help us talk through all of this today. Armando Solorzano, I mentioned, he's an associate professor in family and consumer studies and ethnic studies at the University of Utah. He coordinates the Chicano studies in the university's ethnic studies program. Forgive me. He's author of the book We Remember, We Celebrate, We Believe, Latinos in Utah. And Armando Solorzano, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Hey, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be with us, to be with your audience.
Pamela Perlick is also with us today. We've had her on the program before. She's an economic demographer with the Bureau of Economic and Business Research here at the University of Utah, written on Utah's minority populations. And welcome back to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for inviting me.
And Josie Valdez is with us, vice chair for the Utah Democratic Party, retired as assistant district director for the U.S. Small Business Administration, ran for lieutenant governor in 2008. And glad to have you with us. Thanks very much.
Glad to be here. Buenos dias.
Buenos dias. Okay, so Armando Solorzano, I want to begin with you because I want to get establish some context and some history here.
Uh-huh.
But I wanted to begin something you've told us recently. You say that you use your own personal life as a teaching tool. Your mother was French. Your father was Native Mexican. You're married to an Italian-American. I mean, you're sort of this, I guess, typically American in the sense of being a mix. But you say you use your personal life as a teaching tool. Give me a sense of what you mean by that.
The majority of the people believes that when we teach the history of minorities, Latinos, Mexican-Americans, we take the us versus you approach. Mm-hmm. And that's not accurate. I cannot do that because, again, I'm white, probably a very suspicious white, because my accent, as your audience can detect it. But my mother is French, white person, blue eyes, brown hair. I mean, lighter skin, lighter than some of the people in Utah. Again, I'm white, but also she has the fortune to marry a Native American, a Native Mexican Indian that make me a little bit brown. Okay, so married to Italian women. By accident, I was born in Mexico. But when I go to France, people say that I'm a very rich American because my brown skin, they believe that I'm an American with a lot of money and I spend a lot of time on the beaches. And so, well, that's very interesting. When I arrive to the United States, as soon as I get into this country, immediately as a Latino, I don't have brains. I don't have an intellect. I'm a different person. But what I tell the people, I'm a member of the cosmic race.
Yeah.
I add everything. I am the conglomeration of what all these artificial categories of race we have created, white, brown, purple, red, right? I'm also black if you want me to. Because again, my nanny was one of those African slaves who were running away to the Underground Railroad and ended up in the south of Mexico. And she was my nanny. So again, I carry what is called the human heritage.
Yeah.
So I don't identify with any particular group, but I identify with all of them.
You write in your book that for a long time, people believed the presence of Latinos in Utah was a 20th century phenomenon. And that our history, the history of Latinos has been overlooked and misconstrued. Talk a little bit about what you mean by that.
I'm going to put you in the spot.
Okay.
Your same presentation, deny 50% of what Latinos are, of what Mexican Americans are. Because in your introduction, you don't mention that we were part of the Ute people,
yeah.
The Ute Aztec people. In fact, we start our pilgrimage to create Mexico, Tenochtitlan, from here, from this place. So I feel fully identified with the native people of this area. And that is very, very important to me. Especially we want to reconstruct a history that is fair, that is holistic, and encompassing everybody who has contributed to the creation of this greatest experiment in the world that is called the United States.
You write about that ancestral connection between Mexicans and Native Americans, as you said, the Utes, the Aztecs. So that's a crucial part of understanding this history. You have to start there, I suppose.
Most definitely.
Yeah.
Again, because I cannot understand myself without those roots, without this profound love that I feel for the land. Because, again, it's my mother. Like the Utes and the Aztecs and the Mayans, this time of spring is a sacred time. This is the time when we take our shoes off and we walk carefully because of Mother Earth is preparing the fruits that are coming this spring. We don't want to hurt our Mother Earth. And that part of me, this admiration for the Wasatch Front comes from that roots, from the roots of the indigenous people.
You take note of the fact. I wonder what, at what point did we start to lose that sense of history with Latinos and Native Americans? I mean, you mentioned when the Mormon settlers came, place names, historical markers began to be, that were left by the Dominguez Escalante expedition, for example, they started to be changed.
Mm-hmm.
Is that when this kind of evolution, we started to strip away part of that history for a time?
It comes a little bit before that. And that's what makes Utah a little bit different and unique. In the rest of the Southwest, California, Texas, Colorado, the Europeans mix with the population, not the LDS people. They don't want to mix. That makes different. Because in the rest of the Southwest, you go to California, you will find all these names, San Francisco, Los Angeles, San Buenaventura. But they start changing in Utah because when the pioneers came, they want, and we understand that, they want to build this Zion, the city of God on earth. But they didn't understand that the people who were here, they had a god too, and they want to build the sacred city of Aztlán. And to us, this is where the conversation should start. Mm. These two historical projects are not contradictory. They come together. As soon as we look for issues of justice, equality, representation, dignity, and respect.
This is interesting. You write in your book about how Hispanic populations who came to Utah, for example, in the 1890s, didn't have a Spanish-speaking community in which to live. And they also didn't have, as you say, they didn't have the presence or support of the church where they belonged, the Catholic Church in most cases.
Yes, and that is fundamental. Because, again, we have to create it. We have to struggle to maintain the traditions in the state. And that, again, it is carried out to this present, because we have, again, it's an overwhelming Catholic Latino population.
Right.
80% of the population is Catholic, which again contrasts with what the majority of the people believes, including me. At the beginning, I thought that the majority of Latinos were LDS, but only 13% of the population are LDS. Okay. So again, coming to Utah, we need to recreate. We don't have the support of the Catholic Church either. At the beginning, all these Catholics need to go to Colorado. They need to travel at night just to attend the services. And they use another day to come back. So we need to start building. In fact, the first Catholic Church in southern Utah, in Monticello, St. Joseph, that was built by Hispanic families. And that's the way we start making our presence felt in this state.
So it was Monticello, as you said, in San Juan County. That's where really they started coming through southern Utah, Hispanics, that time.
Right. And it's interesting because these people were the one who were affected by what you just mentioned, the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo of 1848. Remember, the treaty gave the territory belongs to the United States, but the land belonged to the Mexicans. We were the owners of the land. But again, look at history, and there were some mechanisms in places that took our land away. So these people who had no land, who had no other alternative in this country but to be wage earners, they have to start looking for jobs, and that's how they arrived to Utah. That doesn't mean that they were their culture were not present already here.
Yeah.
It's just that, again, in order to survive, and you don't have land, and if the land is taken away from you, then you become like everybody else. You have to travel. You have to look for jobs. And that's what the first Hispanic here came. And it connect with the history of the LDS people because they want to develop the ship industry. But they don't have a clue how to go about it. But you have the Hispanic people who already had big industries. And so they came and helped, which again opened up a new dimension. And this is fundamental to understand. That's what the complexity of the issue is. That's when these stories get together, not only with the Indians, but with the LDS people. Remember that, again, in 1898, when we became the state.
96.
The LDS people who did not agree with leaving behind polygamy, they went to Mexico, and they created the Chihuahua colonies. That's, again, that is history is not told. More importantly, at the time of the Mexican Revolution, 12 years later, the LDS were told by Mexicans, you need to go back. And this is the second time that the LDS crossed the territory without permission. Because remember, they were Mexican, but now Mexicans entered the United States without permission. So you can have it both ways. Which is, again, it portrays a very rich, very deep, very complex. And we are not trying to create a history for the sake of antagonism, but for the sake of creating a common ground when we can sit down, dialogue, and build Utah on a more just premises.
Let me ask you one more thing before we go to a break, and I want to broaden the conversation a bit, because it's interesting. So when you look at the history, one of the things you've talked about is that we have that this community lacks what you call an historical consciousness, which has created this cognitive dissonance. The inner experience, you say, of the individual is not in harmony with the outer circumstances. What do you mean by that? Because that seems to be a really critical point when we're talking about the Latino community today, whether they've settled culturally, whether they've assimilated, all of those kinds of things. What do you mean by that?
When the reality doesn't come together with what you know or who you are. In our countries, at the age of 3 years old, we already know that Utah was part of Mexico. So you come to Utah and say, no, Utah started in 1847. I said, no, what kind of history is that? So psychologically, you start questioning. Somebody's not telling me the truth. Somebody's lying to me. How am I going to put together my internal experience with my external knowledge? And that's when the individuals, the people, might enter into a crisis. That's when the individual start losing identity. That's when the individual said, oh, if it's not true, then I don't belong here. This is not my homeland. You start questioning. And that is carry on in your mind, and it's carry on in reflected in the way you study, in what you study, the way you go to high school, the dropout rates, the sense of belonging that you have for this state.
So whether you feel like you're a part of this place.
Exactly. Because nothing talked about you. It's not the same as the expedition of Dominguez Escalantes. They call the river San Buenaventura, that go to a place where instead of the river, you cross a sea that is called Manti, Lehigh. Those are beautiful names, biblical names. But that, to me, related more to the history of the Hebrew, the Jewish people.
Yeah.
And then I say, and then enter three cultures. Well, is this really in Israel? Is this really the projection of another culture, or is an LDS culture, or is my culture? So there is this dissonance.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I think it's produced, it's not natural. But for me, the sense of coming together is when you overlap all these histories, and what you think is what you see. That again, when they see me, they don't see me as an immigrant. I'm not an immigrant. I never came here. Right? America came to me.
Right.
I never crossed the border. I never crossed the ocean. I never came here. I have always been here, and I will be here because this is my homeland. This is the land of my ancestors. This is the land that talked to me. This is the land where I'm going to be fulfilling my dreams and the dreams of my people.
Mm. Pam Perlick and Josephville doesn't want to get you on this. What do you make of that? Sort of bigger historical context. Does that help you understand, maybe, because we're going to get into some of the issues that Latino communities are facing, but does that help you sort of orient yourself in terms of how we should be thinking about this, that bigger history?
Well, it's interesting. This is Josie. I have always known that this was my people's country. I felt it inside, and there's an oral history, even without educational nuances and facts and history from universities. As a child, you're told, you know, this is tu gente, este es tu pueblo. So you feel it in your innards. But it's true. Then you go to school. It's not mentioned. It's not honored. It's not told to you as a fact, so that you can have that pride. But it's still within you. So to have it put into a context of actual data and information and historical facts at a university level gives real credence. And what it does, for instance, is a lot of our youth, they want to be Latinos for the good things that are out there in the media and are broadcast in the music and the movie stars. But I don't know if I really want to be Latino. I don't speak the language. I every time I go somewhere, the Latinos are mopping the floors and cooking the hamburger. So do I really want to be Latino? So this kind of information is very good and will help, I think, our youth in terms of their feeling of pride and dignity and self-assurance.
Pamperla, you ever thought about that?
When I listen to Armando's talk, he just brings tears to my eyes. I mean, this is the way the history of all people should be understood, contextualized very, very deeply. And so many other cultures whose histories are invisible and other peoples. I mean, we know this with Howard Zinn's famous book, The People's History. You know, its history is written from a very particular point of view for a very particular reason. For me, you know, all of the many voices and visions and intellectual traditions and linguistic traditions, we're so rich here in Utah now. You know, they do the survey of the school kids every fall, and 129 languages spoken in the homes of children in Utah. That's an incredible linguistic, cultural, intellectual heritage that this place has never had, but yes, it has had. You know, just really speaks to me in many ways.
Pam Perlick is with us, a researcher with the Bureau of Economic and Business Research at the University of Utah. Josie Valdez, vice chair for the Utah Democratic Party. And we have Armando Solorzano with us, author of the book We Remember, We Celebrate, We Believe, Latinos in Utah. This week, the Hinckley Institute of Politics is hosting its 17th annual Siciliano Forum. This year's focus, as I mentioned, is the future of U.S.-Latin American relations. The keynote event is today at noon at the University of Utah's Marriott Library. Arturo Valenzuela, the former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for the Western Hemisphere, is giving that address. You can get all the information of all the week's events on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We need to take a break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're exploring the history of Utah's Latino community, which is so complicated. It goes so deep, of course. This was Mexican territory when the Mormon pioneers first arrived, and it goes back to the Native Americans, too, as we've been talking about. The real transformation, or one of them anyway, in the Utah Latino experience did happen in the 1990s. It was a new era when the economic boom brought a large influx of immigrants into the state. This was a wide diversity of people from Mexico, from Central and South America. So this is a conversation today about history and culture and, of course, the challenges today for Utah's Latino community. We have with us Armando Solorzano. He's the author of the book Recuerdo, Celebración and Esperanza, Latinos in Utah. We remember, we celebrate, we believe. We have Pam Perlick with us, researcher with the Bureau of Economic and Business Research at the University of Utah. And Josie Valdez is with us, vice chair of the Utah Democratic Party. So, I want to, Pam Perlick, would you give us a sense of demographics? I suppose, where do we start? I mean, I think that it's interesting when you look at the numbers before the 1990s. We'll get to that. But give us a sense of, I guess, traditional industry. For the Latino population, mining, agriculture. What do we know about that sort of era before the boom?
Well, what we know about it from sort of traditional history and economic statistics are only the people that are part of the formal economy. So much is invisible.
Right.
We have to remember that we don't have a real enumeration of our native people until about the 1920 census. We didn't have Hispanic really as a category. And by the way, Hispanic is a made-up word of the federal government, and didn't really recognize that population until beginning in 1970, but really 1980. So part of that big upslope in minority population in Utah is not that there are more people.
We just started
counting them.
Right.
And, you know, the same thing happens today with people, say, of Middle Eastern descent who are to answer white. I mean, they are not visible. So early on, those traditional industries, agriculture and mining, that brought lots of diverse people, and Hispanics were and Latinos were in those industries.
When we started counting them, finally acknowledging them, what changed?
Well, we had this great financial boom. You know, we had all of this financial wealth created in the 1980s, but really running rampant in the 1990s. And so much of this financial boom was channeled into construction and speculative housing developments. And we know the hotspots for that. So we had this great economic boom in Utah, and really from about 1970 and on, you got to remember Utah didn't hit a million people until the 1970 census. So we're really a little bitty place out in the middle of nowhere. Our connections to the outside world become physically and through markets really established in about 1970. And so the Utah population and economy grow together and become diversified together. The 1990s, a huge boom in migration. And this is when we had many of our new populations come to the state for economic opportunity. Let's also remember that the universities became much larger, and our own University of Utah is a very international place. The LDS Church, too, becomes much more international in focus and begins to put missions in places that bring people here. And then we become a refugee receiving community, too. But it's that great economic boom through the we ramped up for the 2002 Winter Olympic Games, rebuilt I-15 again and again, creating many more jobs than there were people here to satisfy the demand for labor. And so people came to help us build during that boom.
Josie Valdez, one thing you've talked about is this. There was this. It seems like there was this era of like Chicano activism in the 70s and the 80s, and this really produced lawmakers like Pete Suazo, Judge Andrew Valdez was one, Archuleta. It seems like there was a kind of an interesting moment in that time of real a sense of activism. Is that how you would describe it?
Yeah, I've been in Utah since the early 1970s when the Chicano movement was really strong, and it was all part of the civil rights outgrowth. And there was it was a small population, but it was a very active population in terms of activism. And there was a group of us that really got involved in creating change. We were very interested in creating a better image of who this Mexican-American Chicano was. We were interested in changing the negative stereotype that existed in the American psyche about who we were. I mean, the Frito Bandito, the lazy Mexican laying under the cactus with a sombrero, snoozing. We became very involved in making sure that we had equitable access to education, to jobs. I remember we would constantly have marches from the federal building up to the Capitol about changing the height requirement that the Salt Lake Police Department had, because a lot of Mexicans and Chicanos were short and we wanted to serve but couldn't. Access into the schools to make sure that we had access into the universities in terms of the requirements. So there was a tremendous amount of activism. We were interested in voting rights, political rights, housing. I was very involved in equal access to employment. So there was a tremendous movement nationally, but in Utah, it was very, very active. And there was a group that just fought, and we established a statewide organization at that particular time called SOCIO, the Spanish-speaking organization for opportunity, integrity, and community. I mean, and it was big. We had chapters all the way from Price all the way up north. And a lot of activism. And yes, that was when Judge Valdez, Judge Martinez, we were very, very, very active at that particular time in social activism and being a Chicano, brown power.
Yeah.
We were even wearing the brown bands was important to us because we wanted to make changes. And we were making changes on a very fast rate for changes in social activities. It always happens very slow, but we were seeing some very fast changes. And that particular group has continued to be involved in institutions, in banking, in politics. And now that particular group of people are now in our 60s and 70s, and we're very interested in continuing that kind of activism with our younger population.
And are the younger populations as engaged, as interested?
Well, in a different way, because then we were marching and we were, everything was against something. Everything was vocal, very loud, very noisy. Now we try to work within the system to create change. And it's there. The change is there, but it's in a very different way.
But are you worried that it's not there in the same way, that not the same kind of engagement, maybe not the same kind of...
You know, I have gone through the change, and as many of the, you know, the crazy flower children in the 60s and the 70s have become bureaucrats and politicians, I myself have undergone that change. And it doesn't worry me, because we do have the Senator Luz Escamillas. Mm-hmm. We do have the representatives, Angela Romero's out there, that are working within the system for change. We do need to wake up and be a little bit more vocal. I think we've bought into the system a bit much, but change is occurring on a step-by-step basis.
Armando Salarsando, do you see it? Do you see that too? Do you worry about this generation being as engaged?
In a sense, I am, because again, in the past, as Jesse mentioned it, the majority of us were Mexican and Mexican Americans, and now we face a young population of Latinos that are represented by 22 different nations, from Guatemalans, Salvadorians, Argentinians, Brazilians, Colombians. In the time of Jesse, there was something that brought them together. The idea of justice, representation, the struggle for Aztlan, if you want me to put that into place. Mm-hmm. And we were very successful at that time. For Jesse, probably you remember Orlando Rivera.
Absolutely.
He makes the claim that the all Chicano movements in the nation, the one in Utah, was the most successful.
Wow.
And I can give you numbers for that. For instance, in 1967, the University of Utah only has three Chicanos. And it's understandable, again, because the very first Mexican Americans that graduate after 600 years in Utah, the first, it was in 1956, Bill Gonzalez, and you remember him, and still alive. After 500 years of history, our first high school graduate. So Orlando Rivera came and again said, look, at the University of Utah, 1967, we have three students. 7 years later, we have 768.
Wow.
Imagine that growth. So again, if you want to compare results, outcomes of Chicano civil rights movements, we are the one. The problem is that, Jesse mentioned it, nationally, we were not visible. There were a lot of stereotypes on us. Mm. The fact that, again, the way Jesse and Orlando and Bill and Archie and John Flores, and we can start bringing all these names, because there were also people who were not Mexican-Americans, like in the case of the person from Tula, who was the president of Socio for several years. Oh, my goodness, he passed away. Escape. It will come to my mind. So what I'm telling you now is difficult, because how we can put together these young people of 22 different nationalities. And let me clarify this. In the past, we have a very coherent vision. But the United States, because their influence abroad, produced different images in our people. I mean, I have students who came from El Salvador and living here in Utah. But they are living next door to a U.S. person in the army who went to El Salvador to fight against them. So again, you have contradictory views, right? That's one of the dilemmas we face, right? That some Latinos are here and fully support the United States, which is great. That's what we are here for. But also you have other Latinos that come because the influence, the negative influence of in another country, right? So among us, there is that tension, right? What is it that is going to put us together? And I think with Jesse, probably you might agree with me, that can put us together now is the idea of being Americans.
Well,
there's
no
other way.
You mean assimilation?
Definitely not.
The thing that I would like to address is, as we have grown, we've become very diverse. We do have representation from all over South and Central America and even Spain and Portugal across the ocean. But it's interesting because we grow and then we're criticized for not being one.
Exactly.
White people are not one. They have the Sierra Club, you have the Gun Club, they're diverse and everybody has different interests. So do we. Mm-hmm. And we do have organizations that represent commonalities, like La Federación Mexicana, which is a group of hundreds of people from the different states of Mexico that get together and they discuss their interests. And then we have Círculo Argentino, and we have El Grupo Peruano, and we have El Círculo Colombiano. So we're growing and we're changing, and we're coping with that growth and that change. But I think we're meeting it because we're developing new leaders within the different groups. And we do not have one umbrella group that gets us all together.
But isn't it naive to assume there would be one big umbrella?
I think very much so.
Yeah.
I just want to add to the question that Pam addresses. I think that the work she does is amazing. I mean, I'm quite frank with you. Most of my data comes from her. But I know how difficult it is for her to collect it and make sense out of it. You were talking about how do you put it together and how did we come to be represented as a group. In Utah, it's very difficult, especially because our categories of race and ethnicity get conflicted or entangled with issues of religion. Like in the case of, you know, why we were so many in 1970, not in 1960, you know, that was the time when, you know, in 1960, there were, I think 1950, there were only 3,000 Mexican and Mexican Americans. Well, by 1970, there were 70,000.
I'm guessing Pam may know.
Well, the problem is that the categories is that if before, because the concept of the Lamanites, we were classified within the Native American people, with the Indians. And I said that because, you know, when I do my research and I want to know who is who, like in the case of the miners that you were addressing, I have to go to 500 boxes of the Kennecott industry and pull car by car. Oh, this has a Spanish name. Oh, this might be Latino. And that's how I do my... I just don't know how Pam does it. And I really admire your work.
Thank you, Armando. Well, if I might... speaking of numbers, enumerated about 85,000 Hispanics in the 1990 census here in Utah. And by the 2010 census, we're approaching 360,000. So this is, you know, this is really a huge quadrupling of the population. And the Utah population in general, it increased by 60% from 1990 to 2010. And we need to recognize that one out of four new Utah people over this economic boom is Hispanic Latino.
Here's the question, though, that comes from that. How much of that is from immigration? And because I don't want to make a distinction.
Yeah, yeah. No,
but
no.
I think it's interesting to say, okay, we have settled Latino communities here with a deep history, Native American history, history within the state themselves, vibrant political history. But then what happens when you have this influx in the 90s of immigration? How does that change, Pam Perlick? Like, how do you think that changes the dynamic? They don't have the same, you know, they come here. They are immigrants here.
Yes, they're new members of the community. They're new residents bringing new ideas, new connections to other cultures. And so the great majority of people who came in the 1990s were young adults. Mm-hmm. Then they became established. And now, as you noted in your introduction, migration has basically come to a halt, both nationally and here in Utah, and has been since about 2008. Interestingly, in Utah also, births have been falling since 2008 also. If it had not been for these young immigrants who'd come and who had established households, Utah's population would be older, would have smaller household sizes, and of course would be less diverse. Right now, the growth of the Hispanic Latino population here in Utah and nationally is through natural increase. And if you look at the estimates of the native-born, the median age of Hispanics, we know it's a young population. Mm-hmm. The median age is 29. It's 30 for white non-Hispanics, which is the youngest state in the nation. Hispanics are younger, but this is what it's very telling. Let's see. Oh, excuse me. I misspoke. Hispanics, the median age is 23, but for native-born Hispanics, it's 13. And for foreign-born Hispanics, it's 25. For those folks who came then, you see, in their mid-20s, now they're 30 in their mid-30s.
Right, right.
And I know I sat with some of Mayor Becker's staff going through Salt Lake City changes over the last 10 years and showed a big decline in the number of 20 to 24-year-olds in the River District. And it was like, well, why? Well, because they came in their 20 to 24s, and now they're 30 to 34, and mm-hmm. they have children.
Mm-hmm. How does the we need to get to a break, but I want to get to this question because then I want to move to some of the challenges and some of the issues now facing the community. The question of whether or not the documentation question, the illegal immigration question, what sort of a factor is that having on this idea of belonging, whether they become engaged, how you account for them, deal with them? How is that complicating all of this?
Well, it tremendously complicates things and adds some interesting factors into the problem-solving equation, and also in public policy, because we're facing issues that were not there before.
Yeah.
And we have to come together and talk about that, and we will in the next segment.
Great, good. Okay, perfect. That'll get us to a break. Josie Valdez, thank you very much. Vice Chair of the State Democratic Party. We have Pam Perlick here, researcher with the Bureau of Economic and Business Research at the University of Utah. Armando Solarsano with us, author of the book We Remember, We Celebrate, We Believe, Latinos in Utah. This week, the Hinckley Institute of Politics, as I said, is hosting its 17th annual Siciliano Forum, the focus, the future of U.S. Latin American relations. There's a keynote. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Armando Solarsano, Pam Perlick, and Josie Valdez. We're talking about the history of Utah's Latino community and some of the challenges they're facing. I'm trying to transition into some of the issues. We only have, you know, less than 10 minutes to talk about some of this. Pam Perlick, get us started, though. One of the things that you've talked about, one of your concerns, is this intergenerational poverty and, I guess, economic inequality. That do you see that as one of the principal concerns for the Latino
community? Absolutely key, because many of our new residents come with a low income and low education, low levels of education. And the educational system, like all of the other institutions here in Utah, were built for a different time and a different place. And we know, we've seen recent literature that's shown that they have really worked pretty well as far as upward mobility goes for people who were born like in the 1980s. But all of those preconditions for upward mobility that we see in all kinds of international literature, social safety net, good education system, economic stability, all of that, they're no longer in place for these new communities. We're beginning to see the establishment of intergenerational poverty, and it really does involve our new populations and their children. So really absolutely key is rebuilding those infrastructures of opportunity for those fragile households to provide opportunity to economic stability, education, transportation, health care, nutrition, all of that, and then give that next generation the foothold that they need to succeed.
What's the key of that infrastructure? Is it education, reforming the system, making it, adapting it, or what's the key there?
Well, I'm not an education expert, but I do see some great success in the Salt Lake City School District around the idea of community learning centers and the wonderful work that's being done in the Glendale area, the Glendale CLC. It's a multi-sector effort, and then the connections back to the Capital City Education effort, the University of Utah, Salt Lake Community College. We've got to cross all sectors here and be talking. I mean, people don't experience life in these little silos, housing, right. Education.
No, of course. Josie, what do you see? Do you want to talk to that question? this inequality question, this question of not realizing the potential, that must concern you, I guess.
Well, it's of great concern because we do have not only the Latino population, but the other, what we call underrepresented or socially or economically challenged population, our Native American population, Black population, or the immigrants that are coming, the refugees that are coming. It impacts all of these different groups. The fact that we have a system in place basically because, and now, okay, now that I have tended to be in the political arena, so a lot of my observations come from that political perspective because of the public policy and the laws that are created. Mm-hmm. And because we tend to be in Utah a one-party system who believes in helping the individual, and the mm-hmm. laws and the public policies mm-hmm. that are passed mm-hmm. impact and buoy up the individual rather than the community as a whole, mm-hmm. It impacts a lot on these populations. And mm-hmm. so our policies towards education, where many of our politicians refuse to see that there's a gap in education, they refuse to see that there's a great need for health care for everyone as a community, they refuse to see the need for equal opportunity and equity and housing and employment, it impacts on these communities. And so change for these communities, the huge Latino community, we don't see it as something that is like first and foremost on the agenda for problem solving mm-hmm. in terms of political policy. It's a big problem, but we find other ways to continue to work to address it because we must.
I believe we need a substantial change in our institutions in Utah, because the Utah of 20 years ago is not the Utah of today. The conversation at the national level is that this shift in population is coming in 2040, where the Caucasians are going to be the minority of the population. Okay. Two, probably is not a surprise, but in Utah already happened. We have, for instance, Salt Lake School District with 58% of the population being already a minority. We have Ogden School District. We have some charter schools like Uintah High School with 98%. Or the population is already minority, or the immersion schools in the Granite School District. So the system in Utah was not created to attend the diversity of the population to start with. Also was not created with the idea of a community. It's heavily influenced by the individual, by the idea of individualism, competition, which again, it doesn't go with what the state is about. There is a change in the state, and it has to come, because if you look at just in terms of statistics and religious composition, we expect by the year 2030, 52% of the whole LDS population, 52% is going to be Latinos. Uh-huh. Okay, so we are expecting, in the word of a professor from BYU, the Latinization of Utah, the Latinization of the Mormon Church. That, again, has to open. And it has, again, I think the foundations, as Jesse mentioned it, it was arresting on individuals of middle, upper class, white, Anglo-American people. There was no place for diversity. But the reality is that we are here and we need to change. Even if we don't want to do it for moral or ethical reasons, we have to do it for economic reasons. If we don't change, Utah will not be able to compete at the national and at the international level. And we play a big role. So it's a necessity. People want to forget the ethics and the moral behind it. It's fine. You can put that to rest if you want to. But don't forget that down at the bottom, we are humans. And those are the principles that guides our behavior. If you want to do it for economic reasons, do it. Otherwise, we will not be competing in the international market.
And to be clear, Utah's income and wealth distribution has become very much more unequal. Mm-hmm. We are among the most equal of all states, but we're becoming much more unequal. And if you look at the neighborhood level, which is where it all becomes so clear.
Residential segregation.
Yes. We have large enclaves of very deep people in very deep poverty, and enclaves of many dozens and dozens of ethnicities, and including the Mormon ethnicity, in case you hadn't noticed.
Josie, I'm going to give you the final word. About a minute left. How are you thinking about all of this now, wrapping it up?
You know, I've been out and learning about the diverse Latino populations that we have. And it's exciting to see these young people at age 25 to 35 that are here. We ourselves as a Latino community need to wake up to our own power, to our power to vote, to our power to become involved, to speak, to have a voice, to create change, to make change. I am very much an advocate for stepping out and moving forward and being proud of being a Latino in Utah, because we have so much to contribute, but we ourselves need to take the rein and say, I will create my own tomorrow. Mm-hmm. I will partner with those organizations that are wanting to move forward, and I will be part of the positive change for my tomorrow and the tomorrow of my children.
Josie Valdez, Vice Chair of the State's Democratic Party, thank you very much for being with us. Pam Perlick, researcher of the Bureau of Economic and Business Research at the University of Utah, thanks to you, Professor. And Armando Solorzano, author of the book Recuerdo, Celebración y Esperanza, Latinos in Utah, thank you very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
Tomorrow, we continue our coverage with a look at the documentary film Underwater Dreams, which tells the story of four Latino students who entered a collegiate robotics competition with an underwater robot built from Home Depot parts. Join us for that. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Braden Child. Technical direction from Tim Slover. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Out today at noon. You can get all the details on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We need to take another break, though. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.